Welcome again to the Brio Podcast. This is episode number 7. Sorry I took June off from podcasting, basically, but I was busy getting ready for a really awesome trip to Israel. Yes, as you're listening to this, hopefully I will have made my way to Jerusalem with a crew from Zondervan Publishing, where we will be shooting a Bible study series with none other than N.T. Wright, who is really one of the greatest biblical thinkers of our time. I'm looking forward to meeting him and hanging out with the crew while I'm there, but obviously I'm really looking forward to just being there. This is a really awesome opportunity, and we'll be visiting Nazareth and all the other major places around Jerusalem. Then we'll fly to Greece and visit Corinth, and finally wrap up our last few days in Rome. So I feel really blessed to have this opportunity, and I want to share it with all of our listeners. So if you're interested in following my adventures, read my blog at williamhadams.com. Hopefully I'll have time to do some blogging, post a few pictures, maybe a few videos. We'll see what happens. I have no idea yet what kind of internet access and what kind of extra time I'm going to have. So anyway, enough of that. Today I'm excited to bring you guys this podcast featuring Brian Kelly. This was definitely one of the most interesting locations I've done for a podcast. Brian and I recorded this in an RV that he's got some cool community building plans for in the future. Anyway, Brian's the founder and executive director of Common Ground Montgomery, where he and his team are working to build bridges and foster a thriving community in West Montgomery with strong leadership and intact two-parent families. And they want to see their communities care for the underprivileged, the marginalized, and be a place where people can grow in gospel-centered relationships and transform Montgomery and beyond. So, you know, that's obviously a huge undertaking, and it's not without its challenges, as you'll soon hear. So please enjoy this episode of the Brio Podcast with Brian Kelly. So glad that you could make the time to join us here on the Brio Podcast. I'm really looking forward to catching up with you, and always look forward to coming over here to Common Ground to look at what improvements are being made, what's going on in this community. I just have to say, just driving into the community, I get this feeling that things are on a upward track. I know you living in it and being in a part of it, sometimes you may not always feel like you can see that, but as a person that I come in, you know, once or twice a year for different things, I really feel like from, you know, 6 years ago, I think, or 5 years ago, whenever it was the first time that I came over here, feel like I can see how the community has really benefited from Common Ground. So for those who don't know, can you tell us a little bit about this ministry and how it got started?
Yeah, so this June will be 9 years ago that we started Common Ground Montgomery. When we moved here, let me back up a step. We actually didn't move here right away. We moved more on the outskirts of the community. We had not selected a particular neighborhood, but we knew from the beginning that we would find a neighborhood on this part of the city, on the west side of the city. We would focus on that neighborhood with a long-term kind of mission and intentionality of literally between a boundary. You know, for us, it ended up being Fairview on the south, I-65 on the east, Air Base Boulevard on our north, and then, Air Base on our west, and then Day Street on our north. So we picked a geographical boundary, and we knew two things. We knew that we and others that would come alongside us would move into the neighborhood, and we would try to be neighbors. Mm-hmm. We would try to be a part of the fabric of the community and raise our children here and things like that. And we knew that we would focus on ministries or initiatives that would help raise up long-term leadership and or support current long-term leadership. So we wanted leaders to come from the neighborhood, and we wanted to be a part of the neighborhood. And that's really all we knew when we started. So 9 years ago, it looked like being a volunteer coach at Carver High School for the first 2 years. I coached football and baseball, and really just thought coming in, it would just be us for a season while we figured out how the Lord would have us bring structure and a team and a strategy, if you will.
Yeah.
Over time. And so we're asking for that from God rather than coming in with a preconceived notion of how to best serve and be a part of a community. Within literally 2 months of beginning to serve with the kids, Kevin King and Nicole King joined us on a volunteer basis. And then, you know, they were hooked and they were in from the beginning. And so really it was two families that were focusing on how to love a community well and be a part of it. And what that ended up happening over the next 9 years, we selected the Washington Park neighborhood after working at the high school. It was right across the street from the high school. We bought two houses 8 doors down from one another, and with the help of people from Fraser, frankly, and St. James and a handful of other churches, we renovated those homes and moved in. And so we've been serving in the community 9 years. We have been living in the community about 7.5 now. And what came out of that was summer camps with boys who happened to be the younger brothers and cousins of the kids I was coaching football with up at Carver. That led to after school programs, which led to summer camps, which led to us doing various forms of discipleship and Bible studies and mentoring with the kids. And it led over the years to adding staff. And then as we looked at the neighborhood, we led out with sports and then small group Bible studies and things with kids, and then created what we call a safe haven, a space. We eventually bought a warehouse a couple blocks down from our homes, renovated it. It's the current Common Ground facility. And that space became the place where the structures kind of came into being for the after-school program and working with kids. Well, over time, we knew from the beginning that we would have to take a more of a holistic view to see neighborhood transformation, and that kids were not the only step to do that. And so we eventually initiated other ministries like house-to-house community development and what's now called the Urban Seed Exchange. It's about to be rebranded as Yes Montgomery, which is Youth Empowerment Strategies Montgomery. And now we're in the process of partnering to start an all-male academy, a boys Christian school in the neighborhood that will launch this August. And so these other endeavors to see houses renovated, to see adults focused on and financial literacy training and life skills training and community development all together, all that was centered around our relationship with Jesus and helping other people at least understand and begin to come into an understanding of Jesus, but more importantly, a relationship with Christ. And so all of our ministries really revolve around and are driven by that.
You know, we have seen a lot of folks, you know, there's a real movement within the millennial generation to, you know, try to get out and help people. And there's some very positive things among the frustrating things about my generation. It's one of the more positive things. But at the same time, there's a lot of kind of a secular humanist kind of a vibe to a lot of that, even among the Christians. I remember hearing about somebody who asked some folks in Haiti after the earthquake if they recognized the difference between the Red Cross and a particular church-associated ministry, and they just kind of shrugged and said, "No, we don't know what if we thought they were the same thing." So, I'm always really excited to hear from, you know, a Christian organization that isn't afraid to be to be the church, so I just want to say that I think that's awesome, that's always at the forefront of what you guys do. Since I've known you and since I've seen that, I've always seen that here. And you know, I think, gosh, it was we're close to 7 years ago, so you hadn't been in the community long at that point that I think we first met. I interviewed you for a series we were doing at Fraser at the time, and the topic was Unity Through Diversity. And you kind of talked a little bit about a particular event in your life as a young man that kind of led you to realize the plight of the Black community, particularly in the South, just the prejudice that's there and what they have to face. Do you mind talking a little bit about that? That was a powerful story.
Yeah, part of the story for me from the past is that, you know, God used a lot of the history in my life for good. I mean, that's no question about that. And so part of that was growing up, I grew up on the outskirts of, and sometimes right in African-American, low-income, you know, communities that were, I guess, characterized by single parent households, characterized by violence, characterized by poverty, things like that. So growing up, most of my friends happened to be, you know, young Black kids that didn't have dads in the home and that were dealing with a lot of things that I wasn't aware of until we got close to one another and started growing up playing sports together. And so the long story short is I got my own sin plus the neighborhood didn't mix very well. You know, the dynamics of the community that were unhealthy plus the unhealthiness of me led to that when I was 16 years old, I was charged as an adult for drug trafficking and kicked out of school and looking at a minimum 3 years in jail. That's kind of the starting point sentence. And so when I went into the court system, I was able to go with two parents. I still had a dad in the home. We could afford an attorney. I had a nice suit on and all that stuff. And I had to go to the adult court. And I remember sitting on the front row, and they brought in a chain gang of guys that were coming up for, you know, to go before the judge the same way that I was. And they were all adults, with the exception of the two kids that were also 16 years old that were also being charged as an adults like I was. And they were kids that I had grown up with. They were kids that I'd played baseball and football with. They were kids that I'd known since we were 5 years old. And so the experience in the courtroom that day was fascinating for me. I didn't know the Lord. There was no motive to serve God or any of that. I just remember sitting there thinking, well, now what? And I watched as our attorney went back and forth with the prosecuting attorney and the judge. And we all watched how basically a pre-trial deal was made where I didn't get convicted. I got house arrest and probation and work hours, but I got a second chance. Those two boys disappeared that day. I mean, they had already been in the system for a while. The assumption in the room, and this is what I noticed by the looks, by the things that my attorney said to me, by even the things the judge said to me, was I was a good kid that got caught up in a bad situation.
Right.
Whereas those kids were perceived to be trouble. You know, you hear it all. They were thugs. They were this. They were that. Not me, though. When in reality, if you looked at how we grew up, what we were doing, the things we were involved in, I was as bad or probably even worse because I didn't have the deficiencies in my life. I didn't have the reasons to steal. I didn't have the reasons to sell drugs that some of these boys, you could make the case that at least there were some driving factors that were about survival.
Right.
For me, it wasn't about survival.
Yeah, the only differences were your advantages.
That's right. That's right. And I had plenty of advantages. So it was probably a worse situation that I was doing what I was doing, you know. And but the assumption in the room was this kid still got a shot. They don't. Let's get him out of there, you know? And so I got, even in the room that day, a lot of benefits and privileges. And so, you know, that marked me because I remember leaving that day conflicted. Part of me was, these are the kids I grew up with. Part of me was, well, good for me. You know, I'm glad that, maybe I am better, you know, maybe there is something to me that is more important, more valuable. And it wasn't until meeting the Lord in college and really having to rethink and look back at those things in my life to see, you know, what was exposed through that for me. One, the system was not the same for everybody. Two, the assumptions about people were not the same. And I really needed to see that there was a lot of injustice and there was a lot of, the scales just weren't equal. There's just no way around that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what would you say that there was a point later on in your life where you kind of had that realization, you know, looking back on it, where it became clear how unjust it was, or was it more of kind of a slow realization? I really need to do something about that. Where was the point where it drove you to action?
Yeah. So I think it's both. The answer's both. There were some defining moments, and then there's been this unveiling, this slowly but sure kind of understanding of how things are. And part of it is growing up in my kids growing up in this neighborhood and the conversations that we have here, being here now almost 8 years living here. And the other thing was, you know, when I came to know the Lord, I began to read the Bible. That's the problem with that is, you know, you start reading the Bible.
Yeah.
And in the Bible, I began to see, one, how the early church lived together, and two, the challenges they were facing and how people reacted to those challenges. And so I began to see that they were identified with a person, not with a religion or a system or a heritage, but they were identified with a person. That was a big change. They identified themselves with Jesus, and that was the place that the thinking, the relationships, the culture began to mesh and change. Two, that unity that was beginning to happen. As I looked around in my early Christianity, in my campus ministry at Troy, in the churches that I'd been a part of, I didn't see that at all. So I saw a Bible that was demonstrating and talking about life together and what it means to be in Jesus. And I looked around and it didn't add up. It looked more like the same social structures and institutions that the world was living than it did a church in terms of a family that was not just diverse, but really loved one another well across all the boundaries.
Yeah. So. Well, so, I mean, I think what I hear you saying is community really was a large part of that component. Something that you know, you saw in the early church, you know, and reading the Bible, and that, you know, is kind of lacking in a lot of churches today. You know, one of the things that you see a lot in lower income is drug use. You talk about drug trafficking being a particular thing that you were called in for, and an addiction. And recently, I've talked about this before on the podcast, but there was an article that discussed how there was findings that addiction is actually probably closer to our understanding of like bonding, and how if a person can't bond with someone, then they'll bond with something. And when you work in these communities or this community as you have, do you find that to be true, that as people kind of get plugged into the community, that they don't need the more unhealthy behaviors in their life? Is that something that you find to ring true?
Yes, that's a good way to put it. I have to think about that for a second. I think that's part of it for sure. No question. I think. Can't go without saying, but a lot of times when we say that, we're assuming something.
Yeah.
And that is, if the untangling happens for a person that is dealing with addiction, it's because something else kind of came in and untangled it. And so it can be lived out in a healthy way and exposed in community and supported in community. But the assumed thing is that God has really stepped in and helped them untangle. So in other words, they begin to bond with God.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the starting point for me and with a lot of people recovering from addiction. Brings light into their life. It brings connection. They're kind of untangled by the love of God. They're untangled by Him stepping in and doing a lot of deep healing work. And then community affirms that, connects with that. It can be the instrument of God doing it as well. So yes, the bonding, you know, being able to bond in a healthy way with people can not only be the pathway, part of the pathway out, but I think also is probably one of the reasons why people are being driven into addiction in the first place, because they can't deal with pain in their life. What I would say about that is most people see addiction as something that a lot of times it's dealt with on a surface level. You know, I fell into this and I need to get out of this. And what are the steps of health to get out of this? But the reality is there are things driving addiction that you alluded to. It could be not having a healthy bond with people and community and family. That's part of it. I think the other thing is there's just a lot of wounds, whether it's neglect or abuse or there's a lot of trauma in people's lives that work itself into them trying to cope with that pain, and ends up being an outlet of addiction, or an outlet of pornography, which is also an addiction, or an outlet of all kinds of behavior that, you know, need to be dealt with on the deepest level. My understanding is an interaction with God at those deepest levels of woundedness and brokenness is probably, and experientially for me, the best way to be untangled of the very things that lead to addiction. So it's not the addiction, it's the things that are controlling and leading to it. And He uses community and people as part of that process, no question.
Yeah. So. Well, you know, community, you know, God-driven and God-centered community is, you know, obviously just a huge, important aspect, and I mean, that is the church. You know, that's, I think we use the word church, and it actually comes from like some German word. It means like house of God, but you know, the original word meant gathering of people, and you know, I think we get away from that sometimes when we start thinking of going to church and things like that. But you know, it's about community, and you know, I love hearing about what is going on in this community, and you know, wherever possible, you know, helping to support that. And you know, I have friends that are doing urban renewal and living in communities in Lexington, Kentucky, and you know, and in different places like that. And that's, you know, something that you see in every place, is that it's got to be community driven. It can't just be this idea of we're going to move in, you know, or we're going to, you know, reach in and help these people as if we're, you know, some great hope for them. You know, how do you feel like there's any kind of things you have to overcome, obstacles you have to overcome on in this community when you come in as a white man in a predominantly black community, you know, that has the background you have, you know, do you feel like that there's some obstacles you have to overcome in this community to be accepted and be seen as somebody that is actually, you know, trying to help in a loving and Christ-like way, not just, you know, out of some kind of, you know, misplaced guilt or something like that. You know, how do you overcome those obstacles?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's so many of them. I feel like we could take all of our time doing that. One, I think they're, the first obstacle that we would hear about when we came in was, the assumption that we're in and out, that we're going to come, we're going to bring buses in, we're going to bus kids out, we're going to do something, right, but never really participate in the neighborhood. So when we kept saying we were going to move in, well, we were renovating the house and all that, no one believed it. I mean, they really didn't. It was really bizarre to hear the responses. And then when we moved in, that said something to some people. They appreciated it. Okay, he's serious. He wants to be a part of the neighborhood. And then over time, I started to learn a couple things. One is when we use the term incarnational ministry, meaning we're going to live and be a part of and share life with and do life mm-hmm. with people. That's a limited term because only Jesus was truly incarnational. He was the only one that really took on flesh, took on our lifestyles, took on our pain, and dwelt among us in a full way. He's the only one who completely emptied himself out and did that. That's not something any of us do at any level that he does. What we try to do is take on a way of life and, mm-hmm. and do that. But one of the obstacles, I think, was an internal one, and that was we're truly not incarnational. As long as you understand that, that's okay. Mm-hmm. So in other words, I could leave anytime I wanted to. I could go on vacation. I could up and move out. We could take any amount of time because of the resources available to us to do mm-hmm. that. Whereas that's not true for my neighbors. You know, many of our neighbors could not leave and go on a vacation. They could not move out. They could not. They are the circumstances of their lives lead to they're here. This is life. Yeah. They can't even imagine being out of the, not only the circumstances of the neighborhood, but the neighborhood itself. So early on, it would surface like this. A kid would come over and see that we had a dishwasher, and he would be like, "What's that?" You know, like, you know, and he would say things like, "Gosh, you have things that nobody else has." And I didn't even consider that putting a dishwasher in my house would be different. Mm-hmm. But the reality was the fact that my roof didn't leak, and the fact that our central AC worked, and then when we put it in, and the fact that we had a car, and then we had two cars, and you can go on and on and on. Early on, I was really wrestling with, what does it mean to live like our neighbors live, to be effective? Mm-hmm. And the reality is they see me as a multimillionaire because right. of the resources in my life, whether it's resources with the church, resources with family, resources, mm-hmm. the fact there's a mother and a dad in the home. We shifted a few years ago from trying to make it look like we're like everybody else to, you know what, we're going to be us. And we're going to learn in the process together. And people know that we don't make the same income or that we don't have the same limitations in some ways. And that place of actually just knowing our neighbors and getting to know people and do life together and include them in on our life, it began to be, in a sense, okay that we had more. Like, and they didn't care. They just want to know us.
Yeah.
Like, we know you got more. We're not worried about that. Who are you? Are you real? Can mm-hmm. we trust you? And so a barrier, the next one was trust. And as long as we lived authentically before people and lived honestly, and they saw us go through some pretty difficult failures and painful things, and we did that with the community, it was okay that there was distance and there was space between our lifestyle and theirs. It was, but the ones who we did community with, they didn't worry about that anymore. That was there. You had to acknowledge it, but they were less concerned about us being like them and more concerned about us just being us. And so for me, being us and being comfortable and being honest about who we were was the thing that led to more deeper relationships, not trying to pretend like I understood where they were coming from. I don't understand where they're coming from. No matter how many years I live here, I don't understand what it's like to be my neighbor. So I just quit pretending that.
Yeah.
And I just started trying to be honest with them, and they were honest with me, and a growth process, you know, was happening. So that was a barrier of not trying to pretend like I was incarnational. I'm not incarnate. Only Jesus was to that level. Mm-hmm. The litmus test for me was we did take a break. We did move out after about 6 years and took a break for 4 months to kind of focus on some difficult things we were going through as a family. And after 3 months, my oldest son came to me and said, "Dad, I love staying out here. We stayed in the waters. You know, we're on the other side of town in this beautiful community with no shooting and no trash and no speeding cars and no... mainly no shooting. That was one of the things my kids understood. They didn't hear gunshots most nights. And they were like, "This is amazing. You know, you can swim, you can fish, you can run around freely, you can do all these things here." But after 3 months, my oldest son came to me and said, "Dad, this is great. It's fun. I like this place, but when can we go home?" You know, and his that was the switch for me that I realized we had gotten over our barrier, which was, you know, we were just kind of doing this as a ministry. It was home now. You know, and so I can honestly say that
it's
if
kind
we
of a gut check.
Yeah, if we weren't with Common Ground, or if I was relieved of my position, or we just passed it on and moved out, in our mind it's not like, okay, it's time to go. Well, God may lead us to go, but it's not the assumption anymore. This is home. My kids would have two of them were born here. The other two, basically, this is most of their life. So this is their neighborhood, and they don't want to leave it, even though it has issues. So that was a big barrier for us as well. There's probably 30 more, Will. I don't know how far you want to go with that.
Well, I do want to touch, because you're touching on this here, something that, you know, I think I know is a challenge for folks that do this kind of work, where they're trying to move into community, they're trying to build relationships and get to know people and make it home. And yet, at the same time, you know, there's a challenge as a parent that says, is this the right thing for my kids?
Right.
You know, you've got their safety to consider, their, you know, their health, you know, as far as feeling like they're safe, and, you know, and also, you know, their education. Is this, you know, all those kinds of things, is this going to help or hinder with that? You know, you're a dad with several kids, and, you know, you're a protector of them. How do you feel about that? What was that a challenge when you first came in? Was that a big consideration? And you know, you talk about this kind of sabbatical period, you know, and where you come back. Did that kind of change your perspective on it a little bit? Or
yeah, absolutely. So we have 5 kids now. We have 4 boys that are biological children. Then we have a young lady that, you know, is to us, she's a daughter, you know, and she's oldest of all of them. She's 18. My one son's 13, the next one's 11, the next one's 7, the next one's 6. So, it's a big deal to me that they are healthy, that they thrive, that they're, you know, relatively safe. It's a big deal to me that they get the nurturing that would be in line with what God would say is important for a family. You know, but I think that's really the challenge is, what does God think about it? How does he see a family health? How does he see missional life? How does he see a healthy situation? And so coming in, the first question people would ask me, because it was so bizarre to a lot of the white community that we would move into a neighborhood like this one. And so they would ask this question, "Well, look, if you got arrested and charged as an adult as a 16-year-old, what's to keep your kids from going down that same route or worse?" And I also had other family members write me letters. At least one wrote me a letter basically accusing me of betraying my wedding vows. It's pretty serious stuff. Like, you're not taking the vow to protect your family, to be there for you. You're exposing them to things. And it's not a matter of if, but when something happens, how will you justify your life then? And what I appreciated about that, and she doesn't know the Lord, and what I appreciated about it is she said what everybody was thinking. She just said it very clear. So that's what it boils down to, right? How do you justify this kind of decision? And is it reckless? Is it sinful? Mm-hmm. Is it selfish? Is it crazy? You know, what is it? So that's set the table. And yeah. So we had to really think about that. And the conclusion we came to was, one, God had called us to do it. I mean, it was a very clear call to me and my wife, mm-hmm. very clear. Even against the objections of well-meaning godly men, well-meaning family, well-meaning people. But what I knew was that they had blind spots in the same way that I have blind spots. Mm-hmm. So they valued perceived safety over the calling of God. They valued, mm-hmm. You know, the American dream and self-protection as a godly thing. And I think the best way to say it was they had never really thought it through. You yeah. know, they had bought into ways of thinking that didn't look a whole lot like Jesus, especially not his life, his followers, the things that he said in scripture. And so for us, we started one way. We came in knowing we were called and that we were going to do life here. And that was an intentional choice to put us in the path of suffering, in the path of potential things, right? That, mm-hmm. that statistically would happen more in this neighborhood than in other neighborhoods. But because God had told us to do it and we were convinced of that, we could trust him for protection. Mm-hmm. And when the things happen, we would trust that he would use those things for good. And so a couple experiences, you know, of course, my kids have experienced and seen things that most kids mm-hmm. from a middle class white or black community haven't. Mm-hmm. And so my 6 and 7 year old can with eloquence give you any string of cuss words you want to hear. I mean, they are amazing at the things that they know how to express themselves with, right? They can talk about things that you would be shocked that they can talk right. about. But the one thing that we have going for us is that stuff's on the table, that we talk about all of mm-hmm. it, that we try to define it in terms of the kingdom of God. We try to define yeah. it in terms of...
Don't try to put a lid on
what can be contained, what can't be contained, when are appropriate places to use language, when is not appropriate, and the fact that people will disagree on that.
Yeah.
And that community conversation, which includes the grandmother across the street, the families that my kids are growing up around in the neighborhood, what includes their grandmother living on the east side. It includes a community of faith that's broader than any mm-hmm. one denomination or social class. It gives them a way of thinking that, you know, that's going to be shaped over time and they are exposed to tough things. But my answer back to the being was there is no guarantee.
Yeah.
There really is no guarantee they won't sell drugs, they won't be killed, they won't go to prison, they won't make bad choices. I mean, we all do. But we're trusting that the Lord will raise them up in a place of community and maturity that they'll know how to contain and handle those things. And mm-hmm. they might just be pretty amazing missionaries one day because of the experience, yeah. you know, not in spite of. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, that's one part of it. And I think that there's two tensions we all face that are biblical. One is being shrewd as a snake when it comes to evil, mm. and one is being willing to give up your life for the gospel mm-hmm. and being led by the Lord. And so we felt led by the Lord, which included our family. And then we do, especially coming off the sabbatical, as you alluded to, we do have boundaries. We do have places my kids can and cannot go. We do have seasons where, because of what, like there's been 6 murders since Saturday here recently.
Yeah,
it's all of those have affected, well, most of those have affected our neighborhood, whether they've happened here or mm-hmm. not. There's a heightened time going on right now. I'm aware of that. I'm not going to let my kids do certain things that they normally do while we're trying to discern from the Lord what's going on and how we should act in, you know, in this time, in this space. Mm-hmm. So there are seasons and times that we put different boundaries on that we don't have on. And I think those, again, come from asking the Lord, what do you want? How do we respond as a community? How do we respond as a family? And what do we do? And so I think the short answer is, what is God saying to do? And if you mm-hmm. don't believe God speaks and leads, then yeah, this is a crazy decision. But if you do, and you're in tune with that, then you're going to take risks and trust him with those risks. And I've seen him bless those risks. I've seen him do things I never imagined he would do. And so we love that. I mean, we mm-hmm. love it. And my kids love being here. We talk about it all the time. We're not at a place where they feel like they're sacrificing a whole lot to be here. This is just home. You know, yeah. this is what they appreciate and know. And so,
yeah, Well, I think one of the things that we can kind of fool ourselves into thinking, and it sounds like, you know, some of the naysayers in your life, and I think a lot of folks have, you know, they kind of think, well, you know, it's not as if those kids in middle class homes, it's not as if they're totally safe either. It's not as if they never get into drugs or never have, you know, get into some kind of, you know, and of course there you can go on down the list, but you know, a friend of mine that works in one of the high schools locally had two of his students back to back, you know, just die in freak car accidents. And so the idea that we can have this incredible control over the safety of our families is somewhat maybe delusional a little bit. You know, obviously there's measures we can take, but I think, you know, what I kind of hear from you saying is that you know, while you say there's no guarantee, and in some ways you're just saying that's true regardless. I mean, there's no guarantee regardless. And so in some ways you're saying, why not take a risk where you have the opportunity for them to be exposed to a culture that is underserved and see what, you know, what Jesus means by the, you know, the least of these, and which is an unpopular phrase because it can denote some kind of, you know, hierarchy of humanity that I think Jesus didn't intend, obviously, but it really is what he meant, is serving the people that are underserved, that don't have what, you know, many of us you know, do have. And so, you know, the community here is cool to hear about. I really, you know, you talk about it being the conversations that take place where everybody is involved, everybody's plugged in. I really feel like in some ways you guys are embodying the intention for the church in a way that a lot of other churches never really get to experience. And I know in my life I've experienced that at various times where I've had that kind of community where everybody is just kind of involved and pushing forward and moving. And obviously, you know, not everybody in this neighborhood is, but you have, you know, you have the church family, you have the people involved in Common Ground, and there's a lot of conversations that are taking place that allow for the village to help raise the children in some prospects, but also to, you know, for you to at the same time have those boundaries you're talking about and everything. So I think it's so cool to always hear about that, because that's encouraging to me that, you know, that community is happening, that it's taking place. And because I think in that same article I mentioned earlier that talked about addiction and bonding, one of the things that it discussed is how well in American culture, and this article was not a Christian article, just how well we have adapted our communities or our society to avoid community, to isolate ourselves, and how, you know, it's like we're, And I would say the enemy has very cleverly designed a lot of these things in our world to help isolate us, to keep us isolated. And just hearing about people coming together and having conversations about whether it's about curse words and when it's appropriate and not appropriate to use them, or anything else, I just get excited because I really think that is as much a part of what the church is as the, you know, just the corporate worship that we all think of when we think of the church. So now, you know, shifting gears a little bit, one of the things that I like to talk about on the podcast is a little bit of, you know, not just what it is that you're doing in ministry, but what it is you do when you're not at work. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we've talked a lot about your family, what is it that you, Brian, what is it that you do, is a thing that you do to unwind? And I mean, it's, you know, we're, you know, you have I'm sure, your devotional life and those kinds of things that help you center spiritually. But when you just need to relax, what's something that you enjoy doing?
Yeah, so I know I just turned 40 years old this...
You don't look a day over 39.
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah. I was thinking that myself. Yeah. I just turned 40 in July, so I'm about to come back on 41. But I feel like it's been interesting. The last two or three years, I'm discovering what I love to do, what re-energizes me, what gives me life, you know, and then what doesn't. And I had taken personality tests and all those things in years in ministry and in other positions and stuff and trying to figure stuff like that out. But growing up, it was very athletic inclined. You know, I would do sports. I played college baseball. I played football growing up. When I was done, I played anything I could play, basketball, softball. There became a time for me in about the late 30s, you know, where the threat of and the reality of injuries, silly little things that started to happen more and more and more. I thought, you know, that's kind of outweighing athletics for me at this stage in life of being something that is a release and a fun thing for me and something I can excel in. And so it's funny when you get to a point where you use those outlets and they're not available anymore. It's just not worth it to me to go out and play competitive anything because there's a good chance I'm going to break down. You know, I broke my arm about back in October, you know, chasing a thief. And that's a whole nother story. But but the reality that came through chasing the 18-year-old kid was that I'm not 18 and I can't do the things I used to do in the manner I used to do them. And all that to say... that was another reminder. There's got to be different ways to do the very thing you're doing. So what do I love to do? I'm discovering it now, which is interesting. One, I've learned that I really like opportunities, me and my family together, like when we can go to the beach, we do that. We really love it. We didn't know how much we loved it until we last few years, we kind of all got together and talked and we really love the beach. We love to go hiking. You know, I like to hike. I like to go out and hike and do things like that. But oddly, and this is a very boring thing, I think this is going to sound like a lot of people, I didn't realize how much of an introvert I am and was because I like to be with people.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Yeah. And I really, my job is one that I have to talk a lot and lead up front and be with groups. And I enjoy that. But the level of depletion when I go a certain amount of time without being silence and being with silence and solitude or having that, that can be devotionally with the Lord. That can just be by myself, kind of re-energizing. I've realized that I need probably more than a lot of people I know time alone.
Yeah.
And that has been to give myself permission to do that and to enjoy days where they may involve prayer, they may not. They may involve, you know, a lot of intentional learning. They may not. And a lot of times they don't. I've finally given myself freedom to realize that's how God created me and made me. And I get filled in times of being alone, reading, just going to be by myself. And that's not something to feel like I'm wasting life or not being faithful or whatever. So oddly, I really like to be alone during certain gaps of my time. And my wife does too. You know, she knew that about, I didn't know that about me. She knew that about her. And so we will. And it's fun to even create times for one another where you can just go be alone, you know, whether it's at the house on the back porch or taking a day, you know, to go up by Chandler and hike or, you know, something. And so I like that. And it's, and when I find out that when I come back, I really can engage with people. I really can love people well. We figured out what's fun for me is not big groups of people and parties, but going out with another couple and just hanging out, having a drink or two, going out to dinner, laughing, enjoying one another in small, small groups. We love that together as a couple. I love that personally, you know, much more than big parties or something like that. And so I've just discovered that. That's odd, but I'm 40 years old and I just discovered that. And so we are ordering.
I was just going to say, I think with a lot of men in particular, I don't think we tend to be as introspective as women. And so I think what you're talking about is very common. I think there's a lot of guys that can, you know, get to, their 30s or 40s and only begin to kind of think about their personality and, yep. and what that is. And I, you know, it's interesting, you know, you should say, cause we actually kind of talked about the same thing, with Tim Thompson on his podcast and how he considers himself more of an introvert, although no one would realize that,
right.
you know, seeing him up front preaching week after week. But I just think, just to go to your point, it's something that a lot of guys, because we're often forced into that role, that leadership role, because of circumstances or our calling or whatever it is, there's that tendency to think, well, I'm an extrovert, I'm an upfront person. I think it's kind of cool to see guys kind of realize, you know, this is something I really need, is that time alone. When, you know, they've thought their whole time that, you know, they were up front, you know, out there kind of extrovert. So sorry I interrupted you there.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Well, that's what's been happening. And, you know, I really love that I understand that now, and that I don't mm-hmm. make excuses for it, and that now I intentionally set my schedule like that. And so I really enjoy the space of margins in my life, the space of being re-energized that way. But for me, again, it goes back to encounters with God, time to really sit and be with the Lord, with no agenda, no study. I'm just with Him.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very energizing and directive times for me. And I'm learning more and more that being with God and having the space and time to have thoughtful prayer, you know,
yeah.
thoughtful planning, thoughtful time with Him is done more for my life to be able to be better in line to love people well, better
yeah.
in line to be all there with my kids at night, better in line to pay attention to and love my wife well. A lot of it's come from the space to be with God or be alone. And that silence and that solitude has been a gift of realization for me. So I really like that. I mean, again, I'm no athlete anymore, but I enjoy... Now I get to enjoy my kids' kind of athletic stuff, you know, and I'm all there. Mm-hmm. I'm not sitting there thinking about work or other pressures. I get to be yeah. all there. And that's a new thing for me. I mean, that's the last few years, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because this is something that I feel like just ties into something I've been learning. And I'm working on a Master's of Fine Arts right now mm-hmm. and in film. And this past semester, I took a class that is called The Director Prepares, and it's on pre-production, but it's really just more on the entire planning process leading up to the day of production. And, you know, one of the things that I really realized is that I was just terrible at that. And I'm not saying I'm great at it now, but I guess if nothing else, I just realized the need for that. And I think that it just speaks to a need for that kind of process in everybody's life, where before they go and do something, they've had that time of quiet to sit and think and plan and really consider, so that you can be fully there, like you're talking about when your kids are playing, you know, their sports, or when you're actually in whether it's, you know, talking to a teenager here in the community or whatever, that you're not wandering off somewhere thinking about, oh, what have I got to do next, and do I have enough time, should I even be having this conversation, what am I, you know, so you're able to be more in the moment the more time you spend before that time being, you know, letting your mind kind of wander and relax and think and plan and consider what, you know, what all the things that you need to be doing are. But, really having that time to kind of let your brain just, you know, mm-hmm. reboot. And as you're saying, that quiet time with God, such a huge component of that to be able to have that spiritual peace and you know, in the midst of craziness and everything, you know. You mentioned that you read. Have you read anything interesting lately? Any books?
I just finished a book by I guess it's her name's Ruth Haley Barton. It's called Strengthening the Soul of Leadership.
Mm-hmm.
That's one I've actually spent the last 3 or 4 months reading, and a great book. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people hear that, and the whole thought about a book on leadership is how do I be a better leader? And it's usually for some reason, either we take this away or sometimes it's actual that we think that means, you know, you try harder, you learn new tips, you do this, you do that. And the book's fascinating because it's the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. And it's a book, kind of looking at the life of Moses and taking, looking at experiences that Moses had and how they seemed to shape him. Mm-hmm. And then talking experientially from, you know, this person who apparently sets up retreats and helps leaders kind of discern the work of God and the stages of God in their life, and mm-hmm. and working through a lot of normal things that we all face and pressured callings of trying to influence other people. So it's a very beautiful book. God used it a lot to affirm a lot of the things he was doing in my life, of those very things we just said, learning how to sit in silence and solitude and hear from the Lord and be led by the Lord and learn to discern the Lord's will. But then also just dealing with particular, I think, normal things that people face, and especially in ministry jobs,
right.
You know, that we face, and learning how to deal with them in an emotionally healthy way, learning how to deal with them in an honest way, learning how to deal with them in a way that acknowledges trust in God versus our normal inclinations to react or use strengths or use our history to know how to hammer out a solution. It's teaching you and acknowledging that leaders in their maturity do that less and less and less. Mm-hmm. And they learn how to be more and more in tuned with being led by God, being led by the Spirit, and being honest about brokenness and weakness and things like that. So it's just an excellent book. Like I said, just now finishing it over the last 3 or 4 months.
Yeah. Well, I'm always curious to see, as you know, I interviewed a professor of mine for a podcast, a few months ago. And one of the things he said is, I always want to know who's influencing the influencers.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you talk about, the kinds of revelations you have, I am curious to hear, you know, what kind of, books or whatever, whether it's a, particular mentor or, mm-hmm. A Christian thinker that kind of, influences you, if you could recommend one, maybe two books to anybody, whether they're doing ministry work or they're just a, so to speak, average Joe mm-hmm. in the church that's trying to figure out what their calling is or how to, better serve God wherever they are mm-hmm. at, what book would that be or books would that be?
Yeah. So there's a few, and they're, again, these are probably more recent books for me. So they're ones that are fresher on my mind, but there's a few that I would say. Now, again, I feel like I got to give a disclaimer because people don't know me listening to this. I think that there probably aren't many books that I would agree with everything written.
Yeah.
So as I say these books, there's going to be parts in there that you're like, wow, I can't believe that he, So I'm not saying that. I'm saying there's really, God reveals so many beautiful things to so many people, and it doesn't mean that it's all equal in what they say. So just throw out my disclaimer to say, hey, if we had time, I would talk about strengths and weaknesses. I would talk about things I really liked and things I probably just kind of let go. Mm-hmm. And when I read, I dismiss a lot of things and don't even think about them again.
Right.
Whereas somebody else may read it and say, oh my gosh, what is this?
That's their only takeaway. This person got this one thing wrong.
Right. So with that being said, there's a book called Emotionally Healthy Spirituality by Peter Scazzaro.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing book on beginning to understand the need for, I guess what I would say is emotional discipleship, learning how to not dismiss God-given emotions, learning how not to suppress things that are there and that haven't been dealt with just because we became a Christian, but to honestly and in a mature way begin to grow in our character and in our heart and in our emotions. And he gives very practical examples and advice and exposes a lot that we all do and face. And it's a pretty challenging book, but God's used it tremendously in my life over the last few years. So Peter Scazzaro, Emotionally Healthy Spirituality. There's a book called The Joy of Listening to God. And I can't think of the author. It's a female author. I'll have to, maybe get back with you on that one. But it's an amazing, it's an older book, and it's an amazing book on growth in a prayer life from just talking all the time and feeling like prayer is about covering lists and all that stuff and moving towards a learning how to hear from the Lord in prayer. That has been a really encouraging book, probably the first half a lot more than the second half when I was reading the book, but it was a great book, impactful to me. Another book is, let's see, I had one. Oh, so there's a guy named Robert Clinton that wrote a book called The Making of a Leader. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he wrote it back in the 70s. But it's an excellent book for stages in developmental experience and wisdom and discernment for leaders, and how, as they've studied leadership, how certain things are kind of patterns and stuff that we experience and learn, and how God seems to be not in the same order, but seems to be doing these things in leaders' lives. So that's an awesome book. Robert Clinton, Making of a Leader. This one, like I said, Ruth Haley Barton, The Strengthening the Soul of Leadership. Excellent book. There's one more that I thought has been really helpful for me this last year, couple years. I just went blank, Will. So there's
well,
a start.
If it comes to you, you can you can mention it again. You know, a lot of it sounds like, you know, obviously studying leadership is something that, you know, is really speaking to you, particularly right now. And you know, I was at the Willow Creek simulcast. I think, you know, you often go there, bring a few folks from Common Ground, and a few years ago, and one of my coworkers brought his son to it, and he asked me, more or less, he was saying, well, you know, you're not really in a leadership position, so to speak, you know, you're not like in charge of of something exactly. And I kind of said to him, you know, well, I mean, there's different kinds of leadership. And so I guess I pose that to you. What do you say to somebody who, you know, is maybe not in what they think of as a leadership position? You know, what value for them might there be in studying leadership?
Yeah, so the reason I'm enjoying reading books right now along these lines is, one, they're not the what I thought were the typical books of A, B, C, D, and you're a better leader.
Right.
You know, if you grow in all these areas, you'll be an awesome leader. If not, you're really going to mess it all up. I can't do that. Those don't work for me. That's true of marriage. That's true of being a father. Mm-hmm. That's true of being a so-called leader. I can't do the books that say try harder and be better and pray more and do more family devotions and do. I can't do that. That's never worked for me. I either going to end up lying about it or doing it for a season and feeling really good about myself and then falling an incredible failure. Or just chunking it all together.
Yeah. So unless you're type A, I think that's
never worked for me.
Right.
So, you know, that I say that because if you change your thinking about what it means to be the image of God in the world, and that's what I go back to, that if we understand creation and why God made us as image bearers and what it means to multiply and have dominion in the earth, regardless of how you do it, from a standpoint of limitations and gifts and what level of influence, if it's a lot of people or a few people, if you're a teacher or you're a behind the scenes administrator, whatever, your gifts participate in advancing the kingdom of God. And regardless of how we all function that way with our gifts, which I think is a big deal, the other side of it is God has called all of us to learn how to love well. Mm-hmm. To love people and the world, to order our lives in a way to make a difference in the lives relationally in the world. I think the best evangelism is not, and this is my opinion totally, the best evangelism is not all the systems of going out and talking about Jesus. The best evangelism to me is the embodiment of Jesus and the embodiment of a relationship with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Leadership for me,
leadership
for me is learning how to handle those relationships well and steward them well, and learning how to be a conduit of Jesus in the lives of the people that he has called you to love. If it's one person, if it's a million, I don't know. But so because of that, leadership is not just about the executives at the top. Leadership is about everybody being image bearers of God and asking the Lord to lead them to love well where they are or where he's taking them to be. And so I think because of that, everything I've read lately applies to every single person that's out there, you know, not executives, just people that are image bearers. And so my boys are going to be leaders. You're a leader. Everybody that I meet is a leader at some level. They're just not necessarily executives, you know, but they're leaders. And so I'm convinced of that. That's not just, and blowing smoke. I'm convinced that that's the whole point, is the church is supposed to be the priests, right? The holy nation, the priests. Every person is an influencer for Christ, and so they're leaders. And that's real talk. That's not trying to make everybody feel better.
Yeah,
you know, that's real talk. So
yeah. Well, I mean, I know I talk a lot about kind of one of the concept of a personal leadership too. That like leadership even begins just even within your own person. I mean, you talk about how you read a book on leadership and it tells you to go spend some time alone. You know, and you're leading yourself over to this quiet place,
right?
You know, and that's true of whether you're leading a Fortune 500 company, whether you are the CEO, which that position doesn't make you a leader,
right?
You know, it makes you a CEO, but or if you're anybody else. So I totally agree with you. I think that, you know, I think more than your opinion, as you know, you say it's just your opinion. I think that it's, there's a lot of biblical arguments can be made for what you're talking about too, just in the way of, you know, taking a full advantage of the platform you're given as a Christian, just as a human being. I just wanted to touch on briefly, you mentioned your kids and going to see them now has become kind of a pastime to you. It reminded me just of something my dad would say when probably about he was your age, when folks would ask my parents who had four children, what do you do in your spare time? What are your hobbies? And he would say, raising children. do you think in some ways that, there's a lot of guys that will have, kind of an obsession of some sort, whether it's, model boats or, cars or whatever it is, do you think that there's a season in life where a dad just has to be a dad and that's a component of that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. I guess my experience right now is, the Lord's done a lot for me in the last few years and untangled me and healed me of a lot. One of the fruits has been a new or a reconnection with my children. And not only, as we alluded to earlier, being able to have times of being all there with them, but I would say mostly more than anything is learning how to and experiencing delight with them. I really enjoy my kids. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy the uniqueness of each one of them, all five now. I enjoy they're so different. They're so, we have one that's obviously a great athlete and we have one that's an artist and, it's an amazing artist who doesn't want to do any art right now. There's this whole kind of stuff going on. We have the other two younger ones we're still learning and the young lady is still discerning those things, but I love being a part of noticing and paying attention and delighting in them. And I think that's done the most for our relationship than any corrective measures that I'm supposed to do and that I will do. But I think for a long time, it seemed like most of our relationship was built around corrective measures or trying to get them to think a certain way or trying to teach them things all the time. And now it's like, in the same way I'm learning to be with God, I'm also learning to be with my kids. It doesn't do away with responsibility. It's just, for me, I'm really enjoying them and they see that. And that makes a big difference in their life to just be with them and not have to correct and fix them all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, they're kids, they're growing, they're going to make mistakes. They're going to do dumb things. They're going to do even hurtful and mean things.
Yeah.
And it's not that you don't parent. You can't be the friend. You can't just be the delighter.
Right.
But I think that was more absent in our relationship than the other stuff, you know? And so I don't think you could have accused me of not trying to correct all the time, but you really could accuse me of not just enjoying them and who they are. And that makes a big difference. And so I'm in a season where I don't know if I could say it's just that it's my new hobby, but I'm in a season where I really enjoy my kids and I'm so thankful I'm not missing out on any more time of their lives where that was clearly, I was too distracted. I was too corrective. I was too whatever. And I'm enjoying a different season of that right now.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool to hear. And we're at the end of an hour, and I really appreciate you giving us all that time. I know You know, you've got stuff going on. Let me just say that, if you're looking for some low impact, exercise, you can always come out and play frisbee with folks.
Yeah.
I play with. We're not too terribly hardcore. 5:30 on Sundays in the park, and you can find us. Come out, bring the family.
What park is that?
That's Shakespeare.
Okay,
and roll out the blanket. Have them, bring a picnic, whatever.
Yeah.
Folks will bring their whole families. They'll sit on the sidelines. It's fun. You should come sometime. is there any place that people can follow you? Are you a social media type at all, or Common Ground, one or the other?
Yeah. So the answer is yes. From our website or from a Facebook account for Common Ground, you can connect with some of the things I will write and contribute, but definitely some of the other staff. They write blogs and articles, mm-hmm. and things like that. I act old and I am old. And so, I understand Facebook is supposed to be so, obsolete for so many people, but that's kind of the thing that I do. That's what I pay attention to. That's what I every now and then will post and write things.
A third of the planet is still on it. Don't
yeah.
worry.
Yeah. There you go. Okay. But you would get from the cool kids that that's not what
right.
you do anymore. But, Facebook is something that I'm hot and cold on, but I do pay attention to it. And I do post things from time to time, but that's probably the best way. My Twitter is a joke. So, I mean, it wasn't, but I haven't kept up with it as well.
Yeah.
So I think Facebook and, I'm easy to find and, easy to do. Our website is cgmlife.org or you can go to cgm.life and that will kind of connect you with us through the various things that we have going on. But yeah, that's about the best I can give you right now.
Okay. So no, that sounds good. And folks can, visit those and see if they, if they want to get involved, they want to volunteer or offer support for your ministry. I'm sure they can find ways to plug in there. So, if something to our listeners has, pricked your heart, so to speak, you can go check out more, there at, on that website. So, well, thanks again for, joining us. And as I always say to our listeners, make good choices out there. This episode of the Brio Podcast was brought to you by Fraser UMC in Montgomery, Alabama, who is hosting the Global Leadership Summit on August 6th and 7th. If you'd like to know more about how you can be a better leader at work, at home, in your church, and in your community, visit fraserumc.org/summit to sign up today.